Hi, I'm Eric Knowles. I am the president of the Miami-Dade Chamber, having lunch with my brother, Mr. Coleman. Been trying to get up here for a while now. I'm glad to be here. And see, he made sure that it's lunchtime and that he took care of me. So y'all got to excuse this as I'm getting into this brown stew fish.
It's all good. Here we go.
And this is the first time. This is new. Doing an interview, eating lunch. So now, don't close up yours. You got to eat too. So
I was looking for him. You know, I didn't. I usually eat with my hand. Oh, thank you, thank you. Here we go.
Started, sustained, and succeeded. So you can.
Hey, it's Kellen, and today on Diversified Game, I have Mr. Eric Gordon Knowles, and we've been trying to do this one for a while, but it's God's perfect timing, and I'm glad that this is a very political time. Mr. Knowles has such a great resume from Florida, military, Miami Dolphins background, but what he has done in the community, it's just natural that if he was to run for governor, I would not be surprised. But we're going to get into all of that. You guys stay tuned, because if you are in the Miami area, South Florida, going to expand, this is the person who makes connections that has connected people with millions of dollars. We don't like to lead with that because there's a lot of work before that. But Mr. Knowles, welcome to Diversified Game. How are you doing today?
I'm fantastic, man. I'm better now. And this lunch is amazing. What restaurant did this come from?
This is just down the street. Prince, he's a Nigerian, but he cooks a lot of Jamaican food. It's called Jerk Paradise, and I am a very good customer of his because of his food.
Why. This food is great.
Awesome, awesome. I'm glad you see that, Prince. Mr. Knowles, let's start from the beginning, because you are born in Florida.
I am.
Born in Florida. Mm-hmm. But do you have any Caribbean background?
Born in Florida, born in Fort Pierce, which is just up the road. Caribbean background. My grandmother took me to Nassau when I was 8 months old. My father was Bahamian, my grandmother. And that side of the family, my paternal side. And I actually grew up, I don't know whether I say I grew up, but I was there in Nassau from 8 months old to 6 years when my father got out of the military. That's when I matriculated or came back to the United States.
Now, how did that experience, even though you were young, you know, that's your like freest time to play. How was that time, you know, being international?
Excuse me as I work this fish bone. That's one thing about being Caribbean. You know how to work a fish bone.
Yeah. That's what the Africans say, too. You know, and the folks from New Orleans, it's just something about us. You're going to get through it. You're going to swallow it, crush it, something.
Yeah. And then if you do swallow, you know better to find you some bread or something. But, you know, I don't recall a lot of being in the Bahamas before, you know, between that age. But I do remember coming to the U.S. At 6 years old. And the reason I remember that so much is going to my mother and father's house, my grandmother taking me there. I'm sure some of it is, you know, looking at pictures and remembering from that perspective, but I do recall that. And I recall, like I said, my father was in the military. And I recall my mother and I driving from a little town called Lockport, because that's where they were living. Little town outside of Buffalo, New York, east of Niagara Falls, 18 miles east of Niagara Falls. 34 miles north of Buffalo. And I do recall driving to North Carolina. My father was at Fort Bragg. And I remember driving down some of it and picking him up and us driving back to Lockport. And that part is small industrial town, one high school, Lockport Senior High, which I actually graduated from. 28,000 people, small town, one high school, one public high school, one private high school, Catholic high school, and basically two junior highs and a few elementary schools. But my life was pretty interesting growing up. As I mentioned, that's where I started kindergarten at 5 years old, 5, 6. And I was there in the first kindergarten, first and second grade. And then came back to Miami with my grandmother. Like many of us, parents weren't getting along. And my grandmother came and got me and brought me back to Miami. So I'm in Miami, third, fourth, and the first half of fifth grade. And so I guess my parents made up. And I went back to live with them second half of fifth grade after Christmas break. And I'm in Lockport second half of fifth grade, sixth grade, and seventh grade.
I ask that because here in South Florida, almost like being in LA, when you meet someone, black people particularly, you say, hey, how you doing? They ask, where are you from?
Absolutely.
They want to know, you know, Jamaican, Haitian, Bahamian. They want to know, African, what are you? And so I always tell them, I say, well, we're all from Africa. But, you know, it's a long story. How much time do you have? When you came back to Miami and just growing up, was it always kind of like that? Is it a... You know, do people kind of go off into their sections back then?
Of course. I mean, you know, I'm talking about the 60s. Let's say I'll be 70 years old next year.
Oh, bless.
And obviously, those experiences were somewhat different from me because of being Bahamian, having that Bahamian background. Being a Bahamian descendant, that whole mindset was a little different. And I really didn't know what segregation was. It was not something that we spoke about coming from, you know, Nassau, mm-hmm. coming from the Bahamas, even though even in the Bahamas wasn't independent.
Mm.
And so, but it was a black country.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about Miami, and again, not knowing being a child, you know, Miami in the 60s, basically, in the 50s was apartheid. you know, Miami Beach, and so much, and because, you know, you couldn't live on the beach. You had to have a pass as a black person to work over there. As they say, they had signs back in the day, no niggas, no Jews, no dogs.
Mm.
And so that's what the early 60s was like. But again, coming from that Bahamian background, you know, it wasn't a Southern background where it was in your face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like growing up in Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, so on and so forth, South Carolina. Even though maybe my uncle, my grandmother, they were aware of it, but it wasn't something that they pressed down on us as children. But I remember when Martin Luther King got killed, and that's when this whole integration segregation conversation became real to me. And what I say and what I mean by that is I remember having to consciously differentiate the two because mm-hmm. I would mix it up. I didn't, you know, what... Integration meant what? Segregation meant what? And though it took me a minute to remember which was, you know, what was what.
At what year, because when you say no niggas, no Jews, no dogs, at what some point, because coming from Seattle, when you come here, that's all you see on the beach. you know, you hear people from certain places say it's too many Latinos or it's too many Jewish people in Miami. And it's like, okay, well, you stay away. And to me, it's too many dogs everywhere from the grocery store to the restaurants. But at what time did it flip? And what was that like?
Oh, the thing is, because like I told you, I was moving back and forth growing up. So I come here in third grade, and then I go back up to Lockport, middle of fifth grade, and I'm there sixth, seventh grade. And I'm there, when I was there in kindergarten, I was maybe one or two black kids in my class. The rest of it was white. They were either Italian, Polish, or maybe some Jewish, but I was the only black kid on my little league football team growing up.
You were the star.
Yeah, I was that. But and then you come to Miami, to answer your question, I come to Miami in the third grade, and there's all black kids in the classroom. And at that particular time, that's when the Cubans were just starting to come over. So you may have had one or two Cubans children in the classroom, one or two white kids in the classroom, but it was a total flip in terms of my experience of black, white, you know, and that whole situation of being in the classroom.
Okay.
And when you talk about the whole thing about the, you know, no niggas, no Jews, no dogs. My grandmother, as I said, she was a domestic worker. And she actually lived on premises. She worked for two doctors. The Mr. Jacobs, they were Jacobs, and he was a oral surgeon, and she was a general practitioner when it comes to medicine. And she worked, that's who she worked for. And she helped raise their two daughters. You know how that goes. And she was the cook.
Yeah.
The housekeeper, she was a nanny, she was all of that.
Yeah. Seeing that background and seeing how things have changed throughout the years, like, was the military, was it voluntary? Or were you, you know, or were you in a draft situation?
Well, Well, let me tell you. So I said to him, we're going to need bone. So I'm back in Lockport, fifth, sixth, and seventh grade. And eighth grade, remember I told you I was back and forth, my father and mother, going through their isms and schisms. And so I go back to live with them. My mother and father, mother left my father that summer of the seventh grade. And I can kind of speak about this. I've gotten to the point where I can talk about it. But my father committed suicide that summer of the seventh, me coming out of seventh grade. And with that, I came back to live with my grandmother. My father was her only child. And going into the eighth grade, I came back again, to, as I said, to live with my grandmother. And at that time, my grandmother, as I said, lived on premises. She had bought a house, a little two-bedroom house on 53rd Street near I-95. And I came to live with her. Going in today is great. And so, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grade, I'm in Miami. In my senior year, I told my grandmother I wanted to go back and live with my mother. Mm-hmm. So I actually went back to Lockport my senior year and graduated there. And I left out a whole bunch of things.
Some adventures, I'm sure, because that's going back and forth and having to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know.
I was a Boy Scout. 9th grade, 9th, 8th, 9th, 10th grade. I remember my troop leader's hand. I was going to be the first black astronaut. Because I've always been an assertive, a leader. Pretty much everything that I've done. Never became an astronaut, but...
You're closer now than ever, the way things are going and how many more people can get picked.
So, working on this, my father committed suicide because my mother left him. And even in that story, I remember, because I went to live with her. It was the summer, and I went to live with her for a couple weeks. And when I went back home, my dad asked me to show him where she lived. And so I did, you know, not thinking anything of it. And I'm sitting inside his car, convertible, Oldsmobile 88, top down. And he's telling her, if you don't come back, I'm going to kill myself. Mm. And I don't know if that happened a week later or a month later, but it happened. Actually, my cousin who lived next door was spending the night. We were sleeping. My father came to me that Friday night. And he said, I'm going away and I won't be coming back. He said, I want you to promise me one thing, that you'll always be strong. And I woke up the next day and a friend from down the street comes running in my yard. Eric, your father's dead. Mm-hmm. And actually, he didn't die right away. He shot himself in the head and he was in the hospital. I actually went and saw him in the hospital. But he eventually passed away. And, you know, I work with a lot of organizations, 5,000 role models, 100 black men. And, you know, it's such a tragic thing. When it comes to growing up in the black community, fatherless, we all hear about, mothers, single mothers raising children. And that's one of the things that I try to instill in young men is, you know, to thrive, to be the best that they can possibly be. Mm-hmm. So your point of your question was the military. So I had to tell you that to get to that. So my senior year, I graduated. I ran track. I was number one in Western New York. I was a hurdler. And that was something that was my lesson in never saying never. Mm. Because that was the end of the Vietnam era. Mm-hmm. And I said I never joined the army. You know, Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
You had James Brown, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. All that was going on. Never going to join the army. I went to college, I don't know, for a month. I don't think I ever really got to class. But then I said, you know what? I don't want to do this. So I joined the army. And that's how I went into the military. But again, that was my lesson in never saying never.
Yeah.
Because, you know, circumstances will change your perspective on things. And so
Were you at all trying to chase your father's path?
Yeah, actually, I joined the 82nd Airborne. My father was 82nd Airborne paratrooper, and that was a part of it. You know, living that, trying to live somewhat vicariously through my father.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the same time, you know, I'm raised by two women. I didn't really ever have a man in my life to say, this is how you become a man.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point, yeah, I was, with my father, again, being Bahamian, he played cricket.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go to his cricket matches. He played golf. My father and mother played golf. They taught me how to play golf, but I never wasn't something I pursued.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I would have back then. And I wish they would have, you know, made me learn how to play. But it was like, okay, come on, go with us so we, you know, we know where you at.
Yeah. We ain't got no babysitter.
And so he played golf. He played cricket. He bowled. I learned how to bowl with my dad and mom. And so he was that Renaissance man. You know, he did all those things.
And, yeah.
And I remember I wanted a bike. He told me, well, if you get 2 touchdowns this game, I buy you a bike. I got 4 touchdowns that game. And so, yeah, I was definitely trying to live through him to some degree. He was a very good-looking man, too, and that was his downfall. You know,
okay.
Growing up, you know, in the 60s, you ain't had no cell phones. You ain't had no pagers. So, back in the day, you know, your dad, if you ain't see him on the weekend, you see him on Mondays or late Sunday night. You know, that, unfortunately, you know, and that's that Caribbean thing.
Yeah. But is it a Caribbean thing or is it just how, because men from all over, you know, you go to Italy right now, the president can do whatever he wants and it's not a scandal. France, very similar. But Africa, you know, same thing. Pick a country. And my mother-in-law says, and my wife says, a man, a woman, and a rapper. Like the sarong type thing. That's all it takes. And my grandmother has something similar to say. She's still alive, thank God. But it's just, yeah, it's just how things were.
Yeah.
And how things still are. Now you got cameras everywhere.
Right. And you got phone. And you got, you know, where you at?
Yeah.
My phone died.
Location on the phone. Some of y'all are trapped exactly. Like that.
Yeah, you know? Location on the phone. You're right. But anyway, so I joined the Army. I was an 82nd Airborne for 3 years. I knew I wasn't staying in. I wanted to be a buyer, work in retail. So I got out, came back to Miami, went to Miami-Dade, went to FIU, got a degree in apparel management.
Mm.
Never really even worked. Well, I did work in that area because I went to management training. But that's another story in itself. And I left that. And I started working for a nonprofit. And that's how I honed the skills that I have now. I work for a nonprofit as a business developer. And then we also built affordable housing.
Oh, wow.
Back in the 80s. This was the early 80s. 84. 84 until 97. But in between all of that, as you know, I'm an actor and a model.
Mm-hmm.
And I started, you're going to laugh at this. I'm giving you the real story.
Okay, I appreciate it.
I started modeling when I was in the Army.
Okay.
I befriended a pimp. I'm going to give you the real story.
Yeah.
I befriended a pimp. We became friends. Used to, you know, hang out in the pool room and all that.
Yeah.
And he opened a retail store. And so that was my first time doing a fashion show in the opening of his store.
Okay.
And so when I got out of the Army, I started acting and modeling. My counselor, she was an actress / model. And I told her what I wanted to do. And she connected me to my first agent, Marion Poland, back in the day. And like I said, that was in 77.
Oh, wow.
Because I got out of the Army in 76. I was 17. I was 17 when I went in the Army. I was 20 when I got out.
Mm.
And so I went to, as I said, Miami-Dade and went to FIU, studied merchandising, worked for a store called Jordan Marsh. My first job when I got out of Army, I worked at Sears, where the Adrian Arts Center is now. Sears department store was on that corner.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, the white column out front, that's the entrance. That was the main entrance of Sears.
Yeah.
And that tower and the men's store was right there on the corner. So that was my first job working for my good friend Larry Dillard, who unfortunately is no longer with us. But
he wasn't part of the Dillard family, was he?
No. So that was my first job. And then, as I said, I was in college at the time. And when I finished, I did management training with Jordan Marsh, and I was being bounced around. Had bought my first house. I was making $11,000 a year. And talk about $11,000 a year. I remember that was the other thing why I joined the Army, because minimum wage when I was in high school was $1.50 an hour.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so I was like, man, I'm gonna join the Army.
Yeah.
And as far as, you know, what am I going to do? And so fast forward, here I am, a management trainee. Other managers would go on vacation, so they put me in their department to take care of it while they were on vacation, or another manager would quit, they put me in their department. So as the opportunity came along to manage a department, so I went to the CEO, the president, and I say, hey, and I thought me and him had a great relationship, so I went directly to him and say, hey, I heard the department's open, I'd like to apply for it. So the next day, my divisional manager came to me. What you doing talking to the president? And like I said, me and him used to have conversations all the time.
Yeah.
Instead of him saying to me, yo, you need to, you know, go through the chain of command if you want to do this. So I got disenamored with that whole process, and I quit.
Okay.
And that's when I really got into my acting and modeling and landscaping. I'm really into landscaping. I actually wanted to be a landscape architect, but at that time, the only school in the state was University of Florida, and mm-hmm. I just got married. My baby was being born. She's 43 now, so that's 43 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's when I started working for Coconut Grove Local Development, the nonprofit, being the business developer and building affordable housing.
Okay. So now it makes sense why your Instagram looks like it looks. From the dress style, you got it from the player in Making Progress. You guys heard, he was in his first fashion show from a pimp. Even your car that you have, sounds like your dad's car, the car that you had delivered. And then while you're gardening, because, you know, I've been to your house when you had the thing for the Girls Rock. And
yeah, getting ready to do that again.
Yeah, and you guys, check out Girls Rock Miami. Like, if you're looking for
girl power,
you're looking for a nonprofit, because you say the church takes your money and does this, you got to give somebody some money to win. But check out Girl Power. But your yard, you know, and I think you own that whole block. I tell people, he might own the whole block, and I think those are his tenants over there. But that's why everything is laid out, because you've been trained for this. Just how much did the Army help start, you know, you understanding strategy and order? Would you recommend young men nowadays to go into the Army? We always hear mixed things about that.
Well, definitely. Young men or young ladies. That's true. Mm-hmm. I'm working on this fist.
Yeah.
So you slow down.
Oh, yeah, I'm full. It's hard for me to eat something all in one. And while he chews, I'll take an intermission break and show you guys the London and Cindy Explore the World, Cameroon, third book we have. You guys, check it out on Amazon, Instagram, and ask your librarian. That was our quick Telemundo kind of.
All right. So you asked me about, you know, did the Army shape me? Well, like I said, even before, when I played Little League football in the 6th, 7th grade, I was the captain of the team. Mm-hmm. I was a Boy Scout. I was a quartermaster. Quartermaster and the Boy Scout is responsible for making sure all the equipment's in place is right.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're cooking and make sure you got all your pots and your pans and everything for cooking your food and making sure you put all that, you're responsible for putting all that together to make sure that that's being done. And so running track, like I said, I was number one in Western New York. I actually broke the Western New York record in hurdles. So I was always that leader.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went in the Army, the first thing when you actually get off the bus, after you landed at the airport, they put you on the bus, everybody, and they take you to the camp. And you have everybody fall out. The first question they ask you, do we have any re-ups? So persons that had been in the Army got out and came back in.
Mm-hmm.
So they deal with the re-ups. And then they ask, do we have any captains of football teams, any Boy Scouts, leaders?
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing, we had one gentleman, he was a re-up. He became the company leader. Because you have your drill sergeant, you have your senior drill sergeant, you have your drill sergeant, but now you got to get the leadership of who's going to make sure that stuff is done day to day. So this gentleman who was the re-up, he was my platoon leader. So platoon is four squads of 10 men.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was selected to be a squad leader. So at 17, I'm in charge of 10 men.
Wow.
My platoon leader became the company leader.
Mm-hmm.
He was in charge of four platoons. So that's 160 men.
Yeah.
So I became the platoon leader. I was in charge of 40 men.
Wow.
At 17. So you talk about leadership, that's probably where my leadership skills really were honed and developed. And then, you know, you go to, and I was a paratrooper. I jumped out of airplanes. And then you go to your final post. And I was a supply specialist. I took orders, you know. It was like retail. I worked in headquarters, so we were responsible for all the equipment and merchandise that came into the Fort Bragg, because
mm-hmm.
that was our division, 782nd Maintenance Division. Our guys, some of our guys took care of the tanks. They maintained the tanks, the trucks, and so on and so forth of the whole fort of Fort Bragg. And so my job was supplies. So I made sure all supplies, again, remember I was a quartermaster in the Boy Scouts. So that was I just fell into that.
And your dad was there, like you're carrying his legacy. And I'm sure somebody is looking at you like, you know, I knew your father.
Yeah, I'm sure some of that went around.
You know, whether it helped you or not, because maybe things get harder, mm-hmm. depending on how that relationship is.
Oh, the thing, Army was great for me.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, I knew I was only going to be in there for 3 years. But I had discipline. And so I just did my job. Being in the Army, it's almost like, especially in no war or anything going on, it's a 9-to-5 job, basically.
Yeah.
Go in formation at 6 in the morning, go to breakfast, you go to your office and you work. Go to lunch, 5 o'clock, whatever time you're off. The rest of the day is your day.
Yeah.
And so, again, I knew I was only going to be in there for 3 years, so... But again, I was disciplined. I remember guys saying, well, you don't want to work for that guy. He ain't no good. But all they wanted you to do was do your job.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I wanted to take off, if I wanted to take off early on a Friday, because I did my job,
yeah,
it was no problem. You know,
how, you know, doing the Army, coming out, getting married, having your child, your baby, who's now 43. Her and I are probably born in the same year. That must have been scary to say. I followed my father's footsteps, but I can't follow his footsteps all the way.
No.
Like, how? What's the... Okay, people deal with mental health. I've dealt with mental health. I've worked in mental health. I've been a supervisor of a psych hospital or a step-down program for at the psych hospital for kids. What did you do to say, I'm going to shake that demon? That's not going to be my thing.
Well, it's not easy. Like I said, I guess it's those words, last words he told me, you know, always be strong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had to go back and look at that and really digest that sometimes, because it's not easy out here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was, I don't know, 23, 24 when I first got married. Unfortunately, that didn't last. You know, and I always look back and I say, my life growing up was like this 3-4 year change.
Mm.
Now, remember I told you kindergarten, first, second grade,
mm-hmm.
I'm in Lockport. That's kindergarten, first, second, that's 3 years.
Yeah.
Third, fourth, fifth grade, that's 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in Lockport.
Yeah.
Seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth, eleventh, that's 5 years. Eighth, ninth, tenth, and 11th, that's 4 years. I'm back in Miami.
Yeah.
And then my senior year, I go back to Lockport. And then I'm in Army for 3 years. And then I'm in school for 4 years.
Yeah.
So I don't know how true that is or from a psychological perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I got married at a young age, and I was always a go-getter.
Mm-hmm.
I was always a hustler. I started landscaping when I was, like I said, in college, and I would landscape my yards, and then my neighbors would ask me to do theirs, and that gave me really that impetus to really get into landscaping. But unfortunately, like I said, I even talked to Ron Fraser, who was a renowned architect here. I was in my 20s and wanted to talk to him about getting into it, and at the time, the only school for landscape architecture was at the University of Florida up in Gainesville, and I just got married. I wasn't going to go back to school in Gainesville. So I took a few classes of horticulture at FIU, but never got deep into it like I wanted to at that particular time. But, when my daughter was born, it's interesting, you know, a lot of men, they want a son first, but I wanted a daughter. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I got two daughters. So,
yeah.
And I had just had my first grandchild. My daughter just had my first grandchild. So I got the boy.
Yeah. Now with that, and that's such a big jump, and you know, you get married, you're having children, and still, you know, your resume is awesome. How did you, you know, be a father, and then even after, you know, if it's a divorce, how did you, like, you know, keep that focus so you could say, you know what, I want to have some stability in my kid's life. I want to be there. I don't want to have to send them over to the Bahamas,
mm-hmm.
You know, and have them go back and forth like I did.
Yeah. Well, I was always involved. Well, you know, I said fortunately, unfortunately, when her mother and I broke up, I went to New York to pursue my acting career. So again, here it is. I'm up in New York for a couple of years. And I'm like, New York ain't easy. And I never was one to be the star of an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came back to Miami, and which it actually helped because I built all those relationships in New York at the time. So actually I worked more in New York when I came back than when I was in New York those 2 years, because I built those relationships. And then when I came back, I was flying back and forth going to New York to work. And so the hardest part at that particular time, I remember, you know, my daughter asking me, well, Daddy, when you coming home, you know, and I was like, Daddy's working.
Yeah.
Which I was, but, you know, dealing with that. But eventually I came back to Miami. And prior to going to New York, I worked for the nonprofit. Then I left and I came back and worked for them again.
Mm-hmm.
And I just put the time in. When I worked for the nonprofit, I ran some youth programs. So I made sure in the summer that my daughter was involved with the youth programs.
Okay.
And I picked her up, and you know, she lived with me during the summer, that those type of things. And so we just always was engaged with one another. I was always involved, so it never was, you know, absentee father in that respect. And never, you know, meant to let that happen. And you know, my daughter lives in Cape Town in Africa now, and we talk at least 2-3 times a week, if not more. And I went to spend time with her in Cape Town last when my grandson was born in 22, spent a month there, and plan on going again this year and around the Christmas time. And so yeah, that I was always engaged with all, you know, that was easy.
Okay. Sabona to everybody listening in South Africa. You know, Cape Town is a beautiful place. Not a lot of us. Well,
there is a lot of us. No, there is a lot of us. But
not by the water, by the, you know, by the beaches. There's a certain type of people who got all that. They call themselves Afrikaans. And, you know. Well,
the thing about, I was somewhat disappointed. Because I've been to Nigeria. I haven't been to any other African country, but I do plan on visiting other countries. But I had the pleasure of being in Nigeria for 10, 12 days about 6 years ago. But going to Cape Town, absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it reminds you of being in the States.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing Afrocentric about Cape Town at all. And that's the disappointing thing. And even like we have Black History Month, I was like, you know, you go to Ghana, you go to Cape Town or Cameroon, those other countries, and you see it's very Afrocentric.
Mm-hmm.
People are wearing their traditional garb. They only do that in Cape Town. Well, there's some people, but the majority, they only do that when they do something like what we do here, celebrate Black History Month. They
Kwanzaa or something.
Well, I don't know what they call it, but that's when they say they wear their traditional garb.
Yeah.
And it's very disheartening to see that. And the thing about South Africa, it is like Florida. Well, Cape Town, to be exact, because Johannesburg is the industrial part of South Africa, and Cape Town is the vacation.
Mm-hmm.
It's the resort.
Yeah.
And very much like Miami or California, I would say, like you said, on the beach, you look like you're on Ocean Drive.
Yeah.
Except you got the mountains and the 12 disciples behind you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so That's the difference. And you ain't getting in the water because the water's cold as hell.
Only those penguins are getting in that water. That's the only thing.
You ain't getting in the water.
Did you feel welcoming?
It was weird. Yeah. It was weird because, you know, we were at lunch one day where we went to see the penguins.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this lady sitting there with a swastika hanging from her neck.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It didn't mean good luck?
So you know you're sitting there and you're looking around like, you know, are they them or, you know, and then you see, but then the other side of that, you see integration as well. You see Black people and white people sitting and dining and enjoying, and you see Black and white families, you know, so you see that, but then you still got your head over your shoulder because. Even when I was there, before I went, a friend who has a friend that lives there told them about a friend of hers that went into a restaurant by himself. Black gentleman went in a restaurant by himself. He was told he couldn't stay because he didn't come in with a white person.
Interesting.
This particular restaurant. I don't know what restaurant it was.
I wish we knew. We could give him a shout out.
And then the other thing, while I was there, these kids, like 11, 12 years old, went and got into, a community pool.
Mm-hmm.
And the white grown-ups went and beat them up and ran them out of the pool.
Yeah.
And the township, the Black township, came and ran the white folks out of the pool.
Yeah.
So that's still, craziness is still going on. And then the other side of that, like I said, you have that street that looks like Ocean Drive, mm-hmm. but then you still have the townships that look like you're in Haiti.
Yeah.
You know, with the corrugated roofs, and I mean, you got your house is some boards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wherever you can build it. That's the deal with the government. And that swastika, it's crazy that you saw that, because there's a lot of Jewish people in Cape Town. They have whole neighborhoods that they only sell to themselves. And but did you feel with being black or colored? Because I know my first time I was in South Africa, they said, you could be Cossack colored.
Well, I never. Well, the thing is, I didn't get out. We got out a lot, so I shouldn't say that, because I tell you, the wine country, some of the most amazing wine. I mean, it's just beautiful. What really took me, you know, being a landscaper and being into growing things, that's the thing that really got me, because it had such a variety of things being grown. I mean, apples and mangoes being grown at the same place. Mm-hmm. You know, apples grow up in New York.
Yeah.
Peaches grow in Georgia. Mangoes grow in Florida.
Yeah.
But in South Africa, it all grew. You had strawberries. You had lavender fields. You know, you had the grapes, the wine, because, again, the wine is amazing there, South African wine. And we went to a bunch of different wineries. And I guess it's, and I have yet to go to wine country over in California, but it was just amazing. You go to these wineries and you sit there for the day or a few hours, and they have restaurants, and you sit there and drink wine and eat and just have a good time and walk around. Like I said, this one I went to, truly amazing how beautiful and the different flora and fauna, as they say, that they had. But again, and it's inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
It was like several of us, 5, 6, 7 of us, go to a nice restaurant, $300. And I'm talking about appetizers, drinks,
all that.
All of that. And, you know, $300.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's like $20 a person, something like that, whatever it worked out to be. $30, whatever. But just really, really amazing experience. But at the same time, very enlightening in terms of, because again, you're talking about, you know, the coloreds or whatever. You're looking around, you're trying to figure out who's who. Is that a colored?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just something that, you know, your psyche is there, because that's, you know, what you've been told. But the other thing I was going to say earlier, because it is, like I said, like the vacation capital of South Africa, you have a lot of Africans. I think they get some like 50 different languages of various African dialects that are spoken there, because they come from other countries for jobs and that opportunity to work.
Yeah, South Africa has like 12 official languages. So, you know, when you talk 50, Cameroon has 200.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, and it's crazy. But so we may see you in South Africa soon. I know in Cape Town, the Rockefeller has a place for you. It's $100,000. They rent it out for you to 85% occupancy. You can see it right off the freeway. But, you know, it's the Rockefeller. So it's beautiful. So if you guys are in South Africa and, you know, you want to connect, Mr. Knowles, his information will be in the description. But I want you to talk.
Yeah, because my daughter, actually, that's glad you bring that up, because my daughter is just, she and her husband are buying a 7-bedroom house. That's the other thing. Things are cheap there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not cheap, but they're buying a 7-bedroom, which they're going to be using as a guest house. So, yeah.
Okay, that might be your spot. Maybe we don't need the Rockefeller. You just got the 7 bedrooms. It's a lot cheaper than it is to buy in the States, because now people.
Much cheaper than to buy in. Well, definitely much cheaper than to buy in Miami.
Yeah. For sure. But Miami, everything, you know, you have kids graduating, can't buy a house.
Yeah.
Can't afford a house. And, you know, is what should we do? Now, because time, and I said an hour or less, again, I could make a Joe Rogan podcast, but Mr. Noel's got places to go trying to beat that traffic back.
Yes.
Can you talk about just briefly how you got your Miami job? Because every time you get introduced, they mention the Miami Dolphins, and you know people think, oh, if I just get a Procter & Gamble, if I just get Edelman or this and that, everything will be cool. My life will be set. Was the Dolphins, you know, position and what you were able to do something like that where you're like, okay, I can write my own ticket now?
Well, to a certain degree, I don't know if I ever looked at it like that, but I realized my 15 years when I left, like I said, a nonprofit in 97. It was a nonprofit. I didn't have any benefits. So I was like, I got to go get me a real job. And so I started, like, what am I going to do? How am I going to take my skills, you know, working in the community, helping black businesses in Coconut Grove, which is another story in itself, and what's happening now in the Grove. But it's like, okay, maybe community relations. I didn't even know what that was, even though that's what I was doing. And so in life, you know, it's who you know.
Yeah.
But the other side of that, like I always say, it's who knows you.
Yeah. We took that, just so you know. I took that and rolled with it. I tell everybody who will listen that.
Oh, absolutely. Because you know everybody. They don't know you. It don't matter.
Yeah.
And so I knew a gentleman that had sold Pat Riley his house. He knew me. So when I called him and I said, hey, I want to meet Pat Riley because I want to go work for the Heat.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, Pat was touring the country because they were looking at arenas, because the new arena that they're in now wasn't built yet. They were in the old arena.
Okay.
And so Pat wasn't available. And then I just happened to, I was over to a friend's house one Sunday looking through a classified because I was working on my resume. I said, I'm going to go somewhere and open up the newspaper. And there it was, direct community relations director for, at the time, Pro Player Stadium. And so I jumped up, told my friends, I got to go finish my resume. Finished my resume, sent it in, called a friend who I know, Miami-Dade police officer who worked the games. I said, you know somebody who over there? He said, yeah. So his boss, who was over the detail for the games, he knew folks inside, so found out that my resume was in the good pile.
Mm-hmm.
Couple weeks went by. I didn't hear anything. I called. Oh, they said, we hired somebody. I say, okay, Lord, I guess. And I remember saying, I guess, Lord, you ain't time for me to leave yet. So, I don't know, it was a month later or whatever, a couple weeks, I'm on the turnpike passing the stadium. I said, you know what? I'm going to call them tomorrow. I had the HR director's phone, direct line. I called. He said, you won't believe this. I was about to pick up the phone. The person we hired, it didn't work out. We want to talk to you. That was about a month later. So a couple months after that, then I was hired.
Okay.
So, you know, it's about, you know, if you have a dream or you want something bad enough, you know, you pursue it.
Yeah.
And so I had the pleasure of working for the Dolphins in the stadium, 97. But then in 1999, American Airlines called me and offered me the job to be the marketing director for the Caribbean.
Okay.
So, as they say, the Beach Boys song, Jamaica, ooh, Bahamas.
Yeah.
Wanna be. So, that was my job, marketing the Caribbean, doing some projects with, like, Carnival. When I say Carnival, I'm talking about Caribbean Carnival, because they're, you know, the Miami Carnival, they promote all over the world. For people to come here in October, you know, President's, what was it, President's Day weekend? So, yeah.
Did you double dip and then write yourself in as an actor as well in some of the marketing?
No. Actually, I stopped acting when I started working for the Dolphins. Even my boss said, well, if you want to still pursue it. And I said, no, I wanted to focus on learning that business. And so, unfortunately, September 11th happened.
Mm.
And I was in Haiti on September 11th. We were delivering a check for $100,000 for a technical school that was being opened. And so finally got back to Miami 2 weeks later, a week later, because the air was shut down, you know, no planes were flying. So it was like over a week. Get back to Miami. The writing's on the wall that I may not have a job, because, you know, all the airlines, they pretty much collapsed at that time. Yeah. And I got laid off on September 28th. I went back to the Dolphins on November 3rd or something like that as the guest services director. Mm-hmm. So I was in charge of training all the game day staff, training all of them in, you know, guest services, taking customer service and taking care of the cold hot dogs and warm beer complaints. Mm-hmm. So I did that for 3 or 4 years. And as the guest services director, during the games, you have operations director. You're like second in charge behind the operations director. Mm-hmm. And so I did guest services for 3 or 4 years, and then I became the operations director. I ran the stadium for about 4 years. Mm. And in my last 3 or 4 years, I went back to doing government and community. But through that is where I guess I honed my government relations skills, because I dealt with all the elected officials coming to the games and different things that we dealt with, different ordinances that we dealt with. For the stadium. And so I did that, went back to doing government. And so, you know, in terms of, like you said, in terms of me, that elevating my, it definitely elevated who I am, who I was in the community. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I used to do a Halloween event, we call it the Family Fall Festival, because we did it with Antioch Church, and we had like 20,000-30,000 people come out to that, which was, when we first started, it was maybe 10,000. It used to be free. And then to the point we had to charge people at least $5.
Yeah.
And so we did that. Don't do it anymore, but I was that community guy, not just in Miami, but in Dade and Broward as well, because the Dolphins are, you know, South Florida team.
Yeah. So that's like my signature question is, what is your community give back? And that's pretty much like your whole life.
It's always, that's what I've always done, been giving back to the community. As I said, I worked in the Grove, helping black businesses in the Grove, building affordable housing, doing rehab on houses through the City of Miami's rehab program. And then going to American Airlines, unfortunately, that was a short stint, but again, working in the community, because not just here, but throughout the Caribbean. And then, you know, going back to the stadium and really being engaged with, you know, all of South Florida. So I would say, I go back to the whole saying, it's not who knows who you know, it's who knows you.
Give them these last words from doing all these jobs, and people say, okay, do I need to go military? Do I need to go school? He did both, but then he got jobs like Sam Rosti, and they just moved him from, you know, one title to another. And it was like, when does it not matter where whatever title they put you in, you can do the job? Give somebody who's maybe 14 or maybe 44 trying to figure it out, like, what do I need to be doing?
Well, that's a good question, because I would say, and I always tell a person, you don't get promoted because you want to get promoted. You get promoted because you're already doing that job, and the person that's going to promote you sees that you can do the job. Mm-hmm. In other words, I want to get promoted. You don't then start doing the work. You got to do that work before you get there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't get that, you know. As you are matriculating through life, you don't wait. You have to show the initiative. And that's what that is to me, is about initiative. Now, showing that you can do more, you have the ability to do more. And it's not about, well, you ain't paying me to do that.
Yeah.
You know, give you this example. One of my nephews, Okay, Eric, they want me to mop the floor. Well, I can't use the words I use with him, but yeah. Go mop the damn floor.
Yeah.
Because how are you going to be a manager? You know, that's a challenge that we have with our youth today. They all want to be managers. They all want to be in charge. They all want to be, you know, the store owner. And they don't have the skills. Mm-hmm. They haven't. How are you going to manage someone if you haven't done it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's another thing that I see as a challenge that we have with our youth, in particular on, you know, on these social devices, on our phones. You know, they're playing these games, and they think because they're sitting there playing that game that they can actually go out and do it in real life.
Yeah.
And that's not learning the skill.
Yeah.
You know, as Michael Jordan or Kobe would say, you see the results, but you don't see what it took to get to the results.
Yeah.
And they don't know what it takes to get to being able to be on Front Street versus trying to get to Front Street.
So you think it's just humility or just laziness? Instant gratification, if instant you want a nicer word.
Yeah, no, instant gratification. Again, I think it's really from this mindset of social media today. They see this and they think it's, because they see it, they think they can just do it.
Okay.
And it's not a matter of understanding what it took, the work that was behind the scenes to get there.
Yeah.
And I think that's where that instant gratification comes from more so. You know, that microwave society. You know, it's, you know, we grew up, you grew up, I'm sure I grew up, you didn't have a microwave to warm up no food. You had to go in there and put it in a pot. You know, you had to go through the processes.
Yeah.
And they're not going through any processes.
Okay. And I ask that because I always try to break it down even for my personal. But I have clients who say, you started working for free. Why? And I said, not because I didn't need the money, but I just liked the position of what the work was going to be.
But with this, see, that's what I said. It's not about what you're getting paid.
Yeah.
It's about, and see, they're worried about getting paid versus learning the skills to get there. Like you said, you work for free,
yeah.
But that was honing your skills.
Yeah.
So you could get paid.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of a contract I just signed for a good amount of money, and I've already started working on it. We don't know if we got it already, but they told me what their number one is. I said, you guys want to be on calendars? I can start logging the calendars that you want to be on now, right, before a check comes. So when I am in South Africa, wherever I'm at, when it starts, the team and I can already have that part done. So that is your guys' takeaway. Just start now, pay or no pay. There's an old story about pay or no pay. Just have your briefcase or your hard hat ready to work. Let the people know, because an hour, I try to stick to my word. Where can they find more information about you? Are you doing any mentoring? When are you going to start the book? Are you know, you have your own show for the Miami-Dade Chamber, but do you have any other podcasting goals?
No, I haven't really dove into thinking about podcasting. I mean, I do so much, as you say. You know, the Chamber, we have a show called Member Connection that comes on every Monday at noon. And then on Tuesdays, we do the meetup at 4 o'clock via Zoom. I teach yoga. I'm still acting and modeling and running the Chamber. As you know, I thought about running for state representative, and I pulled back on that. I said, I'm doing enough. There are other things that I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to begin working on that, kind of quiet with it right now. I'm just developing what it is. So you'll see some stuff coming out. Because, you know, the one thing, here we are, you know, this influencer thing about being an influencer. And I say, I want to go into that realm and get paid for it, because that's what they're getting paid.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not your average. Like I said, I'll be 70 years old next year, and I'm not your average 69, 70 year old. So I want to, I don't know if I should use the word capitalize, but I want to take the opportunity to encourage, I'm a senior citizen, I guess, encourage others who are in my age group to live their life to the fullest. And, mm-hmm. You know, that's my mantra. The rest of my life will be the best of my life.
You guys have gotten so much game. You've got to fight traffic. until we have flying cars here in Palm Beach to Miami. Brightline, I know you guys are working on something. But until then, a great storyteller, always you want to have more of the story. And there's so much more we could go into. So if you really want to see it, you're going to either hit it in the comments, send email, send them to Mr. Knowles. Don't send them to me because, you know, he'd say we want more. So maybe it will encourage him to do his own podcast, finish his book. I know he has something written down, jotted down.
Yeah, I've done a few things. Yeah, I got some stuff stashed away. I got to pull out of the cobwebs. But if you want to know more about the chamber, you can go to m-dcc.org or call the chamber at 305-751-8648. Our mission is to create opportunities for economic and social transformation in our community, and that's what we do each and every day.
So much game. You guys have gotten it. Thank you for staying to the end. Now you can like the game. You can subscribe. But the most important thing is for you to share this game with somebody. It will change their life. Y'all be blessed.
Hello, everyone. Join us on an exciting journey with Explore the World Cameroon. London and Sydney will take you explore Cameroon, the heart of Africa. Experience the vibrant culture, nature, and traditions from Yaoundé Market to rainforest adventures. Every page is a new discovery. Join the Cameroonian food, music, and wildlife with our explorers. This book is a true celebration of Cameroon spirit. Get your copy now. Available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and through your library and bookstores via Ingram Spark. Don't miss this adventure.
Are you tired of the rat race in America? Are you ready to visit the motherland to relax and rejuvenate? Are you ready to explore all that Africa has to offer? Then check out the brand new Diversified Game Academy course, Prepare for My First Trip to Africa. Are you worried about being able to afford the trip? We got you. We will show you how to travel either on a budget or as a baller. Learn how to stress the value of the USD. Did you know that 100 United States dollars is worth over 1,000 South African rand or 10,000 Kenyan shillings? Or 54,250 West African CFA? Are you worried about taking your kids? Get the game from Kellen Cash, a bona fide world traveler, having traveled to almost 20 countries, several of those in Africa. Get the game on taking your kids on their first trips. Learn how to find the best tickets, get the visas, and plan your own adventures in Africa. Don't let Eddie Murphy have all the fun. Plan your own coming to Africa trip, starring you, produced by you, and featuring you. If you are ready for a life-changing experience, sign up for our course today, Diversified Game Academy. Get prepared and purchase at diversifiedgame.com.